Last time we ended up talking about the classification of kingdoms and dichotomous keys. And today we want to start talking about the organisms that are commonly considered to be bacteria. We actually have two different classification systems that I've introduced to you for the bacteria. When we were talking about just the five kingdoms system, we said that they're all classified underneath Monera, the kingdom Monera. In your textbook, it actually has the bacteria classified in two separate domains, the archaea and the eubacteria. But basically, whether or not we're talking about archaea, eubacteria, or monera, the bacteria all have one characteristic in common, and that is that they have prokaryotic cells. Okay. So their cells lack a membrane-bound nucleus, they lack membrane-bound organelles. And so we're looking at a typical bacterial cell here. Some of the bacterial cells, as you can see in this picture, will have cilia and flagellum both. But the bacterial cells only reproduce asexually via budding. They have no sexual reproduction. Okay. And so they're fairly simple organisms. They're single-celled organisms, as we mentioned before, as well. So when we look at bacteria, one of the ways of classifying bacteria is by their shape. Bacteria have one of three different shapes. They have a spherical shape, which you can see on the left-hand side of the screen. Spheres, of course, are three-dimensional circles, essentially, right? And the spheres are sometimes called cocci bacteria. So when you hear of a name of a bacterium such as Streptococcus, you know the shape of the bacterium, right? It's a spherical shaped bacterium. The second shape that bacteria can have are rod shaped. As you can see, the middle picture there depicts the rod-shaped bacteria. Of course, a rod is kind of a three-dimensional rectangle, so to speak. That's why they look kind of like rectangles on a picture, because a picture is two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. But these rods are sometimes called bacilli. Okay. So bacillus bacteria are rod-shaped. The third shape that bacteria can be is they can be spiral shaped. The spiral shaped bacteria are called spirillium. And you're looking at some pictures of some spirillium bacteria here. The spirillium bacteria, when you look at them underneath a microscope, you actually have to change the focus of your microscope up and down to see the whole bacterium. Because what they are is they look almost like a spring. All of you know what a spring looks like. It's a three-dimensional spiral type of a thing. So when you're looking at them underneath the microscope, in order to see the whole bacterium, you kind of have to change the focus, because there's a difference in the depth of the bacterium. That makes sense. Okay. So those are the three main shapes that bacteria can be. Another major way of classifying bacteria is whether or not they are what we call gram-positive or gram-negative. Now, with bacteria, they don't have eyes or ears or leaves or something that's fairly easy to look at and say, oh yeah, this bacterium belongs to this particular family or this particular genus. And so we actually have to run tests on the bacterium. And one of the main tests one of the very first tests that they will run on a bacterium if they're trying to classify it, is we call a Gram test. Gram is a stain, essentially. Okay. And only certain types of bacteria can hold that stain, and they're what we would call the gram-positive bacteria, and they're typically purple in color. So the bacillus bacterium that you see here in this picture would be gram-positive. The spirillium and the cocci bacterium in this picture would be gram-negative. Gram-negative bacteria are typically reddish or pink in color. And basically the difference between gram-positive and gram-negative bacterium is gram-positive bacterium have a cell wall. The cell wall, however, is different from the cell wall that we talked about in plants. It's not made of cellulose. It's a little bit different. But what happens is when you put this particular stain on the bacterium, if they have a cell wall, that stain gets trapped in between the cell wall and therefore gives them a kind of a purplish type of a color.
Which one was the one with the cell wall, the negative or the positive?
The positive. So kind of think of it this way, the purple stain hooks into the, kind of wedges its way or infiltrates into the cell wall, and therefore they are kind of purplish in color. Any other questions about that? So these are some gram-positive cocci here. These are some gram-positive bacilli, and these are some gram-negative spirillium bacterium. Now, when we talk about microorganisms and bacterium, one of the ways that we use to grow these bacterium is we use something that's called a petri dish. Okay. Most of you have seen petri dishes before with bacteria growing on a petri dish. Looks something like this here. Other tests that are run on bacteria, many of them, have to do with what substances are in the petri dish. Generally, within a petri dish, there's something that's called agar, which is nutritional substance that's made out of a plant material, and we'll talk about the plant material a little bit later. But this allows the bacterium to have energy in order to grow. When microbiologists want to learn what bacterium they're looking at, what they'll do is they'll actually use different types of agar. They have what they call, for example, blood agar, agar with the blood of pigs or cows in it. Some bacteria can't grow in blood agar, some bacteria can. And then, you know, they use other types of agar to grow the bacteria, other chemicals to test the bacteria. Some of you that are in the lab, one of your labs, you will do a computer simulation of bacteria testing, okay, kind of being a microbiologist. Now, I'll tell you right up front, I'm not a microbiologist. In fact, this is probably my weakest area of biology. My philosophy is if I can't see it, it probably doesn't exist anyway. It's not important enough for me to study, right? But you can actually take classes in microbiology. We teach a couple different microbiology classes here at Snow College. So I'm just going to kind of go over generally microbiology because, again, I'm probably least familiar with this particular group of bacteria. So when we talk about bacteria, again, there were two major groups of bacteria, the Archaebacteria and the Eubacteria. All right. Now, whether or not you classify them as domains or just as one kingdom, the kingdom Monera, it probably, as far as I'm concerned, it really doesn't matter. For the test, you probably need to know both classification systems. But the Archaebacteria are all bacteria that live in very, very harsh environments. They live in places where pretty much no other organism can survive. They have a specialized cell wall and some other mechanisms that allow them to live in these extremely harsh environments. We're going to talk about three different groups of Archaebacteria. The first are what we call the methanogens. And they actually live in methane gas. Okay. So where would you find methane gas? Yeah.
Caves?
Sometimes caves.
Is that like volcanoes?
Sometimes volcanoes can get methane gas. Where do we see methane most commonly in our lives? It's your natural gas. Okay. They can actually live in your natural gas pipes, which is a pretty harsh environment, right? Not many organisms could survive there. Another place where you'll find methane is in the gut of a cow, for example. Okay. You can find... So methane gas is a really harsh environment. Now these organisms are autotrophic. They're a little bit different as far as autotrophs go from what we've talked about before. Before we talked about autotrophs as kind of being somewhat synonymous with photosynthetic organisms, right? When we think of autotrophs, we think of those organisms that photosynthesize. And most of the autotrophs that we'll talk about in this class do fall into that category. However, some autotrophs, such as methanogens, are actually what we call chemiautotrophs. What they actually do is they use the energy in the methane bonds in order to survive. Okay? There's not a lot of energy in methane bonds. There's not a lot of energy at all. So these organisms are using very, very small amounts of energy by breaking apart the bonds in methane gas. Okay? And so they're called chemiautotrophs, which are, there's only going to be a few different organisms that we talk about, most of them belonging to the archaebacteria, that are true chemiautotrophs. Okay? Most organisms that are autotrophic do photosynthesize. Another group of archaebacteria are what we call the thermal acidophils. Okay. To be philic, what does that mean again? Talked about it.
Love.
To love, okay, or to like. And so they like hot, acid environments. Okay, now hot acid environments are those that you would find in a hot pool. Okay, for example, in the hot pools of Yellowstone. Right, most organisms cannot survive there. One, it's too hot, right? And the other is that they're slightly acidic, and it's hard for most organisms to live in acidic environments. Thermal acidophils, however, are able to live in these hot acidic environments, such as in the hot springs of Yellowstone. Or another place where you'll find them is, say, for example, in other hot springs like, I don't know if any of you have been to Honeyville, to the hot springs there, or out to, what's the name of that place out west of Lehigh?
Saratoga Springs.
Yeah. Lava hot springs in Idaho. Thermal acidophilic bacteria will live in those types of environments as well. Okay, and in fact, in Yellowstone, the different colors in the different pools in Yellowstone are actually, the reason why the pools are different colors is because of the species of thermal acidophilic bacteria that live in these pools. Okay, and actually, people have actually stolen bacteria out of the Yellowstone pools because there are actually some beneficial uses to thermal acidophils. Okay? Now, thermal acidophilic bacteria, they're actually chemiautotrophs as well, okay, as are most of the archaebacteria. And what they actually use is they, in these hot acidic environments, there are a lot of sulfur bonds, and they use bond, they use the energy between sulfur bonds in order to survive. Another place where you'll find these thermoacidophilic bacteria around here, I should have mentioned, is out west or south of Manti, between Manti and Sterling. Any of you ever gone off the hill there, south of Manti, and you can smell the sulfur smell? You always hit your buddy and say, you know, who's letting wind when you go off the hill, right? And actually, that those are thermal acidophilic environments. There's little hot pools that come out of the ground there, and they actually have these archaebacteria there, these thermal acidophilic bacteria. And whenever you're around the hot pools, whether it's Yellowstone or one of the other hot pools that I mentioned, they always have that sulfur smell. You ever notice that? Any of you have ever been around them? And so they're using the energy in sulfur bonds in order to survive, which is, again, a very different way of getting energy. Okay? Any questions about those? The third group of archaebacteria that we want to mention are the halophils. Of course, this means to love or to like, again, to be philic. Halo means salt. Okay? These organisms live in salty environments. For example, you can find some halophytic
archaeobacteria in the salt flats out west of Tooele and Grantsville, and between there and Wendover. Now, before, when we were talking about osmosis, we said most organisms can't live in those salt flats, right? In fact, you don't really see any organisms living out there. Why is that? Yeah, it's not that there's no water, but they can't hold the water in the plant because the solute concentration is too high outside the plant, so the water leaves the plant, right? Okay. So functionally, they don't have available water. All right. However, these extreme halophytic bacteria can live in these salty environments, and they do not dry out. They have special cellular mechanisms that keep them from drying out. And what they actually use is they actually are chemiotrophs as well, and use the energy in the crystalline structure of salt as their energy base. Okay, and so archaeobacteria are a group of bacteria that are kind of quite a bit different from other types of bacteria. Any questions about those? Now, the rest of the bacteria are classified as eubacteria. U means good, so their name translates as good bacteria. However, all the rest of the bacteria in the world belong to the eubacteria, besides those that are in the archaeobacteria. And not all of them are good to humans. Okay, what they're actually saying by calling them eubacteria is that they're kind of normal bacteria, quote unquote, rather than these kind of extreme, or these bacteria that live in extreme environments. Okay, so eubacteria would include anything such as pneumonia bacteria, okay, which you would not consider to be a good bacterium, to other bacteria that are useful and good for humans, such as actinomycetes. Okay, so there are, within the eubacteria, there are good bacteria for humans and bad bacteria for humans, so to speak. All right. Now, one group of bacteria that scientists typically classify as eubacteria, but there are some scientists who actually classify them as a different domain, are what we call the cyanobacteria. The cyanobacteria are a group of bacteria that are different from other bacteria in that they can photosynthesize. Okay, these bacteria actually photosynthesize. And you're looking at some pictures of some cyanobacteria here. These bacteria are actually quite large in relationship to other bacteria. They can get they can get to be as large as a millimeter in diameter, which is huge for a bacterium. Okay, most bacterium are, you know, so small we can't see them, and you can barely see them with a normal microscope. Okay.
So this one's almost visible to see without.
Yeah, if you know what you're looking at, you can see them like on a microscope slide. So, you know, when I have a slide of cyanobacterium, I can hold it up to the light and actually see the little green specks in there. Okay. So the cyanobacteria are actually photosynthetic, so they are autotrophic as well. So in the bacteria, at least in it, there are some bacteria, such as the archaeobacteria, that are chemiautotrophs, and then other bacteria, such as the cyanobacteria, that are photoautotrophs, or they photosynthesize. And that's typically what we think of when we think of autotrophic organisms again. The cyanobacteria are typically found in freshwater pools of water, okay? So freshwater environments. Any questions about those? Now, the rest of the eubacteria, I'm just going to kind of go through and give you some examples of some different types of eubacteria. There's one group or family that's called the spirochete family. The spirochete family includes most of the spirillium bacteria. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples of some spirillium bacteria. One of them belongs to the genus Borrelia. Borrelia causes a disease called Lyme disease. Any of you heard of Lyme disease before?
Yeah.
It's transferred by ticks. We don't get it that common in the western United States, but in the east, if you get ticks on you, you ought to be checked for Lyme disease.
Another common, or another well-known, I should say, spirochete bacterium is the bacterium that causes syphilis. Okay, belongs to the genus Treponema. But syphilis, of course, is a sexually transmitted disease. Now, one of the things that's kind of interesting about the Spirillium bacterium is that when you get, if you catch a Spirillium bacterium, the bacterium kind of infects the cells and infects especially certain types of the cells of the human body. And when they first infect the cells, there's not a lot of symptoms. It's kind of an asymptomatic type of bacterium. The types of cells that are really important that these Spirillium bacterium attack are nerve cells, as well as some sensory types of cells, for example, in the eyes. And so what happens is if you were to get something like syphilis, you may not know that you have syphilis for a period of time. You can be asymptomatic. As soon as you have symptoms, you should go get it treated, because if you don't, syphilis can actually cause a person to go crazy, can cause them to go blind, some other not so good results. Okay. The same thing is true, similar kinds of things are true with Lyme disease. A lot of times people with Lyme disease are asymptomatic for a while. Again, it attacks the nervous cells, and it can be a debilitating disease, a lifelong debilitating disease. Because a lot of times when neuron cells are damaged, they can't go through mitosis and make new neurons, okay, or nervous cells. Any questions about the spirochetes? This picture up here is actually a picture of syphilis, okay? And you can see the spirillium nature of the bacterium. Okay. There's a group of bacterium called the gram-negative facultative anaerobic rods, which means that they must live in anaerobic environments. Some examples of anaerobic gram-negative anaerobic rods include Salmonella, which causes typhoid fever and food poisoning. Most of you have heard of Salmonella before. Cholera is caused by this particular group of bacteria, as well as the bubonic plague. Okay, bubonic plague at one point killed probably over half of Europe in the history of the world. Y'all heard about the plague before, bubonic plague. I don't know, have I mentioned this, the song Ring Around the Rosies? Have I mentioned that in this class? It's actually about the bubonic plague. Okay, when you get the plague, you get these little rosaceous, kind of like splotches on your skin. That's the ring around the rosies. And what they thought they could do during the plague is if you put flowers on them, they thought that would stop the spread of the disease. So that's pocket full of posies. And then what they would do is anybody with the plague, they'd take them out in the street and they would burn them. And that's the last part of the little saying that kids use. Ashes, ashes, we all fall down, right? Okay. So it's about bubonic plague. And I don't have any pictures of gram-negative rods, at least right here. Another example of a bacteria is the rickettsias and chlamydias. Of course, chlamydia, which is a sexually transmitted disease, belongs to this group, as well as Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Okay. The gram-positive cocci include things such as Staphylococcus and Streptococcus, which are bacteria that can infect you and cause some problems with humans. There are a group of bacterium that are called the endospore-forming bacteria. The endospore-forming bacteria are an interesting group of bacteria. They actually produce these spores that can stay dormant for sometimes as many as 10 years. Okay? And when they become active, many times these endospore-forming bacteria produce toxins. Okay? Toxins that are some of the most deadly toxins known to man. For example,
One of the endospore-forming bacteria that you have heard of probably somewhat recently is anthrax. Well, have you heard of anthrax? Around 9/11, there was some releases of anthrax. Another one, if you're really into fishing, almost at every pond and river, there's little signs that say, wash your boots when you get out of this pond or river because of what? No fishermen in here. You heard of whirling disease? Okay. Whirling disease also belongs to this group, as well as another disease-causing agent, one that's called mad cow disease. Also, within the genus Clostridium, there's two very important bacterial toxins that can be produced, botulism and tetanus. Tetanus, of course, most of you get tetanus shots. That's why when you step on a rusty nail or something, they suggest that you get tetanus shots every so often. And the reason why is those nails may have these spores, these endospores on them, and if they get into your skin, they can then become active and actually cause a very, very painful death. Okay. Another example is botulism. Botulism is typically food. It's typically found in food, but the botulism toxin is the most deadly toxin known to man. An ounce of botulism toxin, if you put it in the water supply of a city the size of Chicago, it would kill everybody in Chicago. Okay. That was one of the worries around 9/11. I don't know if you guys can remember that far back. You know, it's a while ago, but when they were started to have military personnel protecting water treatment facilities and so forth, because something like botulism toxin could be very deadly. You typically pick up botulism, as I mentioned, in kind of spoiled food, for example. You've all probably heard if you get a can of food and it's been dented and so forth, that you what? Been dented really bad. Have you heard this?
For half price.
Yeah, you get it for half price. That's true. But if it's kind of older, they tell you not to eat it, right? Because it could have botulism in it. It's also why your moms, if any of your moms can, okay, they put the lid on and then they put it in a hot pot, boil the hot pot up, and then they set all the bottles out. And they wait for the lid to seal, a little pop, right? Any of you, some of your moms can. Those of you whose moms can, you've seen that. And the ones that don't pop, they do what with? You eat them right away, right? And that's because botulism cannot survive in an anaerobic environment. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to put that lid on so that no new air can get into that food, okay? And then you're boiling it to try and kill what little, if there is botulism bacterium in there, you're trying to kill it as well as any other bacterium. Okay. Any questions about that? So, you know, you get an old bottle of something, and if it looks like it has something growing in it, or if you think the lid might not be sealed, you just want to throw it away. Okay, even if, almost if you're starving, because you'll die if you don't. Any questions about those? The last group of bacteria I just want to mention a little bit about are the actinomycetes. These are kind of mold-like bacteria. They act very similar to molds. You can find them a lot of times in the soil. And another place where you can find them is some aquatic environments. And they are sometimes parasites or symbionts of plants. For example, but sometimes they can be quite deadly. The Mycobacterium produces a disease called tuberculosis. The Streptomycetes actually produce a substance that serves as antibiotics. And so some of them can be used antibiotically. Others of them are actually used in cheeses and yogurts. Does anybody in here eat yogurt? Okay, most of you. I can't stand yogurt. I'm I don't see rotten milk like that, just at least not until it's gelled up into a cheese or something. But when you eat yogurts or cheeses, they all have a little bit different taste to them, right? And the thing that actually gives them their different taste are the bacteria. Okay. For example, in Swiss cheese, there's actually a bacterium that produces gases, and that's what makes the cheese have holes in it. Okay. And so when you're eating cheeses and yogurts, you're actually eating bacteria. You might have heard of this before. They say if you eat yogurts or cheeses, the flora of your stomach is actually better. Any of you have heard that before? You actually don't get as many diseases, and that's because you're coating your stomach or putting good bacteria into your stomach. It's kind of interesting. The bacteria are the most numerous organisms on Earth as far as numbers of individuals. And for example, on your body alone, you will have millions of bacteria. And most of them are not very harmful. However, some of them can be harmful. Okay, some of them are actually beneficial to us. Right? And if you guys had a petri dish, some of you will get this in lab, you can almost take, like rub your finger along here or any other surface, and then rub it on a petri dish, and you'll get bacteria to grow. And that's because bacteria are basically found everywhere. Okay. Any questions about the bacteria? The next kingdom then that we want to talk about is the kingdom Protista. Now, out of all the chapters in your book, the one chapter that I don't want you to read is the chapter on Protista. As I mentioned before, the protists are a group of organisms that there's still a lot of argument in the scientific community as to what organisms should be classified as protists. In this class, we classified the protists as single-cell eukaryotic organisms. Okay, and your book does not classify them the same way. Again, don't read your book in this one chapter. Okay, just get the handout off the web and kind of use that. But protists are very common throughout the world. One place where you find quite a few different protists are in freshwater environments. Now, we'll find that you can find a lot of protists in saltwater environments as well. But this picture kind of shows some of the diversity of protists that you might find in a freshwater pool around here. Okay. It's kind of interesting. Did any of you, who's in lab in here, by the way? Okay, about half of you. When you looked at the Spirogyra that you got out of the bottle, remember the green plant material when you were learning how to use the microscope? Did any of you see little things moving around in the water in there by the Spirogyra? If you did, those little things that were moving around were probably protists. Okay? So most freshwater environments have protists. And this is one of the main reasons why we treat our water. For example, we'll find that one of the protists gives you a disease called Giardia. Okay, there are some others that we'll talk about later on. But the protists can be very detrimental to a human's health. If you go to a foreign country, a lot of foreign kind of third world countries, I guess you'd say, or almost third world countries, they tell you not to drink the water, and that's because of protists that are found in the water. Okay, and one thing that you don't want to do is you don't want to drink, or you don't want to use ice from those countries either, okay? Because those protists are still alive in the ice. Okay? My dad and mom, they've traveled all over in the world. It's kind of their hobby is to travel all over. But before my dad retired, he actually got a job offer to work for the UN. And he was going to go to India for 6 months and do some consulting with the United Nations there. And he and my mom got into India, and when they got off the plane, they got arrested, believe it or not. And my mom and dad were really stressed out about this, and the UN visited the Indian government. Finally, they let my mom and dad out of these Indian jails, which my parents said were just unbelievably bad, you know. Open sewer trenches running through all the the rooms and everything. And so then the Indian government said, well, you can stay in Delhi, but you can't. He was actually going to work up near the Himalayas in India. And so they were there for about 2 weeks. And while they were there, they knew they shouldn't drink the water, but I guess the water was all, you know, all the bottled water was warm and stuff. So my dad actually took some ice cubes out of a fridge and put it in his water, and he got really sick. He was sick for about 6 months after that. Finally, they kicked my mom and dad out of the country. And right after they kicked them out of the country, it was when India was actually first doing its nuclear testing, and the area where my dad was supposed to work was about 30 miles away from where they were actually doing the nuclear testing. So they were trying to keep all the UN people out of that area and stuff, which is kind of interesting. So if you go to a country, don't drink the ice cubes, or don't put ice cubes in your water and then drink the water. Okay? You can catch a lot of protists that way as well. So many of the protists are parasites of humans, and actually one parasite in particular in Guinea Protista actually kills more people in the world today than any other disease, and that's the protist that causes a disease called malaria. We've mentioned malaria before. Malaria is a protist, and so some of the protists can be very detrimental. There are very few that are actually a direct benefit to humans. There are some that have indirect benefits for humans, but not many of them. Okay. We're going to talk about, I think it's seven different phyla within the kingdom Protista. The first phylum is the phylum Euglenophyta. The common name for these organisms are the Euglena. All right. Some of you may have heard of Euglena before. It's one of the better known of the protists because a lot of high school biology teachers will actually show them to their students. The Euglenophyta are actually an autotrophic group of protists, and they do photosynthesize. Now, one strange thing about Euglenophyta, however, is if you get them out of sunlight, if you put them in the dark, they'll actually turn heterotrophic and start eating other protists. But most of the time, they are autotrophic, and so we're going to consider them to be autotrophic protists. Okay, they are found in freshwater environments. And so you find them in freshwater environments. They actually have two flagella in the Euglena. They have a long flagellum and a short flagellum. The long flagellum actually serves a purpose that we've talked about with flagellum. It serves to help the Euglena move. However, the Euglena move a little bit differently than other flagellated cells that we've talked about. Most of the time when you think of a cell that's flagellated like a sperm, the flagellum beats and it pushes the organism opposite the way of the flagellum, right? Okay. Euglena, when its flagellum moves, it moves in such a way that the Euglena moves in this direction, okay, towards the flagellum. So it kind of pulls the organism along. This little short flagellum, they actually use as a rudder to actually guide where the Euglena is going. Right? And so key characteristics of the Euglenophyta are that they have two flagella, a long flagellum and a short flagellum, and they are autotrophic. Those two characteristics basically distinguish the Euglena from all other protists. Okay. This is looking at a microscope slide of Euglena. You can see the flagellum here, so this would be the way the organism would move, is towards the flagellum. They always have a structure that's called an eye spot as well, which is fairly distinguishing, and it's always kind of reddish when you look at them underneath the microscope slide. Okay. Any questions about the Euglenophyta? The next phylum that we want to talk about is the phylum Chrysophyta. The phylum Chrysophyta are sometimes called diatoms or the golden brown algae. Okay, the diatoms or golden brown algae or the Chrysophyta are all found in marine environments. These organisms are
autotrophic, and they do photosynthesize. In fact, they make up the base of the food chain in the open ocean. In the open ocean, there are not a lot of plants growing out in the middle of the ocean, right? Okay. Why is that?
Because the floor is too far down.
Yeah, the ocean floor is too far down, and plants typically have to be attached to something, right? And so these organisms can kind of just float in the water, and they are photosynthetic. And they make up a part of the ocean organisms that we call the phytoplankton. Any of you heard of phytoplankton before? Phytoplankton are the basis of the food chain in the ocean. Zooplankton, which are small animal-like organisms, feed on the phytoplankton, and then things such as whales feed on the zooplankton. Okay, so they're the basis of the food chain. And the phylum Chrysophyta is one of the key components of this phytoplankton. We're going to talk about the other phylum that makes up the phytoplankton here in just a few seconds. One key characteristic of the Chrysophyta is that they all have a shell that surrounds the organism. And if you look at this picture, what do these shells look like to you? What does it look like they're made of? Mr. Stack, we'll ask you since it should be a hand, since I asked you. What does your dad work with?
Looks like glass.
Looks like glass. Okay, good answer. It does look like glass. And what they're made of is they're made of silica. Okay? What they do is they pick up silica out of the ocean, and silica is what we make glass out of. And so they have these little shells that are basically made up of silica or glass-like particles. Okay? And what they do is they help to protect the Chrysophyta from predators. Alright? Now, there's lots of Chrysophyta out in the open ocean. And one thing that we find is that silica is an abrasive. Okay? So silica is really good to scrub things with. And what we actually do as humans, we actually use the dead Chrysophyta. We'll actually dredge them up from the bottom of the ocean, and then we'll take the silica and crush it, and we'll put it in things such as toothpaste. So you guys may have had the skeleton or the shell of a dead Chrysophyta in your mouth this morning. Okay, and what it does is it helps you to shine your teeth up. They're also used in like silver polishes, you know, things that need an abrasive. Sometimes their shells and their coloration can be quite beautiful. There's actually people who do artwork out of these organisms. You can buy these microscope slides for like $100,000 with artwork on them. And use your microscope to look at your artwork. Okay. These are some diatoms here. Again, you can see kind of that silica or glass-like shell. This is another diatom, species of diatom. This one's actually living, or it's kind of been frozen as a, and it has the green color, so therefore you could tell that it was photosynthetic. Okay. Any questions about the Chrysophyta? The next phylum is the phylum Pyrophyta. By the way, the ending phyta, I should mention this, the ending phyta means plants. And to begin with, these organisms were first of all classified as plants, the Euglenophyta, the Chrysophyta, and the Pyrophyta, because they photosynthesized. However, because they don't necessarily have a cell wall and other components of a plant cell, they then decided that they were no longer plants but belonged to the protists. But the ending phyta still kind of stuck. The Pyrophyta is the third phyla of protists that we're going to talk about, and the last one of the protists that is photosynthetic. Okay, so these organisms are autotrophic, and they are photosynthetics. These organisms are only found in marine environments.
And they are the other group of organisms that make up the phytoplankton out in the open ocean. So the phytoplankton are made up of the pyrophyta and the chrysophyta. Okay, does that kind of make sense? So basically they're marine photosynthetic protists. Okay. These organisms have a flagellum, at least one. In this picture here, the ones that we're looking at, they actually have three flagellum, which is kind of unique. Most cells that are flagellated don't have three flagellum. They typically only have one or two, right? But the pyrophyta will have anywhere from one, two, three, sometimes four flagella. So they can be a little bit variable in the number of flagella they have. But so that's one of their distinguishing characteristics, is they are marine and they are flagellated. So that way you can distinguish them from the euglenophyta. The euglenophyta are only found in freshwater environments and they're flagellated, right? So those characteristics kind of in combination help to distinguish them. They do have one other characteristic that is quite distinguishing, and that is that they are bioluminescent. They're bioluminescent. There's something else that I wanted to. Now, what bioluminescent means is, first of all, does anybody know what it means? Yeah. To give off light. So these are living organisms that give off light. That's what luminescent means. And that's where they actually get their phylum name from, is they get their phylum name from the ability of them to be bioluminescent. The phylum name, Pyrophyta, pyro means what?
Fire.
So the fire phylum, the fire plant. So they actually give off light. You'll actually find these organisms in the ocean, and typically they'll give off light at night when they're being perturbed. For example, if a series of fish or something swim through them, or if a boat goes through them, it'll kind of churn them up and they'll become bioluminescent. I actually saw some of these organisms my dad took our whole family when I was about 16, and we rode the ferry up through the Inland Passage in Alaska, and camped out on the top of the boat. We didn't have a cabin or anything. We were kind of with all the hippies, I guess you could say. It was kind of fun. But behind the boat at night, you'd actually look back there, and it would glow behind the boat, and it was these bioluminescent pyrophyta. Any questions? They're sometimes called the. Any questions about the pyrophyta? This is another example of a pyrophyta here. Any questions about the pyrophyta? Okay, let's go ahead and stop there for today. On Wednesday, we're going to finish up the protista, and we'll also get into the fungi. So again, be sure to get the handouts, and then also